So I like to, when I'm giving talks to the general audiences, I like to say that there's, you know, I like to try to explain the sense in which we don't understand the foundations of quantum theories. With the following analogy, it's possible to know how to drive a car, how to use a car to get from point A to point B, without being a mechanic and knowing how the car functions and, you know, what to do if it breaks down and how to improve its performance. And our relationship to quantum theory is a bit like that. We're extremely good at using it to answer questions that we're interested in across all sorts of fields, but we don't have a deep understanding of it, and it's not clear that were it to break down and fail, we would really know how to fix it. So the field of quantum foundations is interested in getting a deeper understanding of quantum theory, and the activities in the field are usefully broken up roughly into these three. So one activity is to try to provide an adequate interpretation for the theory. So this is basically trying to figure out, you know, what does it tell us is going on in the world? What sort of picture of the world does it give? The second is exploring non-classical phenomena. So things like Bell's theorem, the quantum Zeno paradox, the quantum eraser experiment, anything that seems to be challenging to explain from a classical point of view is something that in quantum foundations we like to focus on because it informs us about these other questions. So for example, it might help us figure out in what way quantum theory is innovation relative to classical theories and therefore what is the correct interpretation of the theory. And the third item on the list is to determine principles from which the quantum formalism may be derived. So if you go to a textbook, you'll find postulates for quantum theory that tell you things like states are vectors in Hilbert space over a complex field and systems combined by tensor product. And those are mathematical postulates, and it's not clear where they come from. If you contrast that with the situation in relativity theory where we have the Lorentz transformations, but we also have some physical principles, namely the relativity postulate and the light postulate, from which we can derive those. And so we'd like to have something similar for quantum theory. So we have these mathematical postulates, but we'd like to know, are there some physical principles from which we could derive those and answer questions like, you know, why is it the complex field and not the quaternionic field? Why is it Hilbert space at all? Why do systems combine by tensor product, not some other sort of product? And so one way of thinking about that axiomatization project is to sort of imagine a space of possible theories, the way the world could be, and we're trying to find axioms that pick out quantum theory from within that space. So that, roughly speaking, is some of the activities that happen in quantum foundations. And what's very useful, so a good trick to get clear on interpretational issues and on deriving the formalism is to try to think about some you know, deep philosophical principles about the way the world might be and then put them to the test and see if quantum mechanics really abides by those principles. So this is really a process by which thought experiments can be turned into real experiments, okay? And this is sort of the gold standard in foundations. If you can take some deep philosophical principle and ultimately turn it into something that's mathematically well-defined and then an experimental test, that's really the best you can hope for. And so the quintessential example of this is Bell's theorem, and actually the term experimental metaphysics is due to Abner Shimoni, and it was describing Bell's theorem. And so the story really starts all the way back in 1935 with the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, which introduced this thought experiment of two quantum systems that are space-like separated and entangled and subjected to measurements. And it was in 1964 that Bell modified that thought experiment slightly and showed that under the assumption of local causality, you cannot explain, so under the assumption that causal influences propagate slower than the speed of light, you cannot explain the correlations we see in a quantum experiment. But of course, his very first inequality in that first paper was actually not robust to experimental errors, and it only took a few years until Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt came up with a better inequality that was robust to experimental errors. And then just a few years after that, this inequality was tested in experiment, shown to be violated. After that, there have been many, many experiments which have sought to seal various loopholes, ways that the world could have tried to simulate Bell inequality violations while still being locally causal. And all the loopholes have not been sealed simultaneously, but probably in the near future, we'll see the first loophole-free Bell experiment being done. Meanwhile, on the theoretical side, there's been lots of developments. So for example, you know, the early work was finding, you know, a particular inequality on experimental statistics that followed from assumptions of local causality. Now we sort of know the full set of correlations that can be achieved under that assumption, so that forms a polytope. And there's been a huge amount of work on trying to refine, you know, what are the relevant assumptions that go into Bell's theorem? You know, what's the best way of parsing those assumptions? Which ones are the most likely ones that we should reject? And there's also, in parallel to that, been a lot of work done on applications of Bell inequality violations. So that's sort of a generic. When you look at a no-go theorem like Bell's theorem, there are a few of these in quantum foundations. You might ask, well, why should we be interested in that? You know, that no-go theorem says that, you know, there's some idea about the world that, well, I didn't even believe it anyhow, but it says it can't happen, so, well, we can just move on and not be interested in that anymore. But these no-go theorems are significant because whereas a lot of debates about, for example, what's the innovation of quantum theory might take the form of, well, according to my favorite interpretation, this aspect of the classical world has to be given up, and quantum theory teaches us that the world is this way. But we can argue about that, whereas a no-go theorem is an attempt to formalize assumptions and then prove that some set of assumptions is strictly inconsistent with the predictions of quantum theory. So that's a much higher bar to try to achieve. So it's the most precise and least subjective statement about the ways in which quantum theory differs from the way a classical world is. And then, secondly, there's practical significance to these no-go theorems. So particularly if the assumptions of that no-go theorems embody some sort of principles that hold true in a classical world, then once you show that quantum mechanics violates one of those assumptions, you know that, in some sense, there's no classical simulation of those quantum predictions, and therefore there's a possibility of using those effects to power information processing tasks, for example. So roughly speaking, non-classicality is a resource, and that's another good reason to try to understand these no-go theorems. So what I'm going to do in this talk is rather than try to, you know, survey all the various no-go theorems and work that people do in the field on experimental metaphysics, I thought it would be useful to sort of dig deeper into one particular topic, because then you'll sort of get a flavor for how this sort of research progresses. And so I've chosen the Cochen spectra theorem. So this is, I think, alongside Bell's theorem, one of the most important clues we have for the way in which quantum theory is different from classical theory. It's a theorem from the 60s. It's not as well known as Bell's theorem. But I chose it because, well, first of all, it's something that I've worked a lot on. And in the fall, a visiting grad student, Ravi Kunjwal, came to Perimeter, and he was working on this question of how do we take the Cochen spectra theorem and turn it into something that's experimentally testable. And it turns out we made a lot of progress, and just in the last month we sort of had a breakthrough, and now I feel like for the first time we have some experimental inequalities that are robust to experimental error that we can really test. And so I'm really excited about this, and I just kind of thought it would be fun to tell you about it and see if it might be connected to other things that people are working on. So that's one reason. But also the topic of the Cochen spectra theorem connects to the work, well, it connects to many things in quantum foundations, but in particular to the work of some people at PI. So Matt Liefer and Matt Pusey work on topics that are very related, Cecilia and Tobias as well. And I'm going to mention in my talk where things overlap with their research, but I won't really have time to go into detail into what they're doing, so just ask them about it. This talk is going to provide you with sort of enough of the conceptual framework that you'll be able to make sense of what they're doing. Okay. So it's the Cochen spectra theorem is from 1967. It started in the late 50s, early 60s, when Ernst Specker was thinking about incompatible quantum measurements, and he started wondering whether, although you can't measure these incompatible measurements simultaneously, could it be that the outcomes of these other measurements are nonetheless determined? Might it be that there's some more complete description of the quantum system in terms of hidden variables, for example, such that the outcomes of all those measurements you might do are really determined? And amusingly, he claims to have thought this up in the context of Sort of in Christian theology, people wondered whether God's omniscience extended to the truths of counterfactual claims. And so he wanted to know, could God know the outcomes of incompatible quantum measurements or not? The original proof from 1967 is quite complicated. It involves 117 rays in a three-dimensional Hilbert space. And over the years, people have simplified those proofs significantly. So I'm going to use this one. It's a proof in a four-dimensional Hilbert space with 18 rays due to these guys. And so the idea is that I'm going to just represent those guys by this graph. So every vertex on this graph is a ray in that four-dimensional Hilbert space. And any quadruple that's enclosed corresponds to a basis. So these four elements here are a basis of that four-dimensional space. So are these. And so this ray here at their intersection is part of this basis and this basis. So for this particular set, you'll notice that every ray appears in precisely two bases. There are 18 rays, and there are 9 bases in all. So the question of whether you can assign an outcome to all these measurements simultaneously can be boiled down to whether it's possible to assign values 1 and 0. So 1 means this outcome will occur in the measurement. 0 means this outcome will not occur. Can I assign 0, 1 values such that for every quadruple, exactly one of the outcomes gets 1 and the other 3 gets 0? So you try, and you know, you set down a 1 and some zeros. That means that for this quadruple, these guys have to be 0, because this one's 1. And you go along, and you do pretty well until you get down here, and then you find that you get a contradiction. So if I look at this ray here, if I consider it as an outcome of this measurement, then it ought to not occur, because I've already got this outcome occurring. So I should assign it 0. But if I look at this measurement here with these four guys, well, the three of them receive 0, so it should receive the outcome 1. And so I have a contradiction. Therefore, God's omniscience does not extend to the truths of counterfactual claims about quantum measurements. Except it's not that simple. There are some assumptions that underlie the Cauchy-Speckert theorem. And just to make them vivid, if I think of a three-dimensional Hilbert space, two bases that share some ray in common, Cauchy-Speckert assumed that the value you assign to this ray is the same regardless of which basis it's considered a part of. So if it receives the value 1, it does it for both bases. If it receives the value 0, it does in both bases as well. If I did not abide by that assumption and allowed that the assignment to a ray like this one could depend on the basis, the context, then there would be no contradiction. I would assign it a 0 in this basis and a 1 in this basis. So those are called contextual assignments. And so the assumption of these theorems is non-contextuality, that the value assignments don't depend on context. So the question is, can we test the Cauchy-Speckert theorem experimentally? And so there's this nice quote from David Merman, which says, the whole idea of an experimental test of this theorem just misses the point. And I remember in the late 90s thinking exactly the same thing when this question got presented to me. Look, this is a theorem about the possibilities for interpreting quantum mechanics. It's just a fact about how we should think about quantum mechanics. But then I realized thereafter that and many other people started realizing that, we should be able to do better. We should be able to turn the insights of the Cauchy-Speckert theorem into a test. And so the idea is we have to identify those particular facts about nature that seem to mean that we can't have a non-contextual model of what's going on. So we don't want to just say, well, you know, the evidence for quantum theory is evidence against these models. No, what precisely is it about quantum theory that makes these models impossible? That's what we have to try to identify. Okay, so to do that, I need to give you some sort of framework. So here I'm going to be telling you about some tools that are used frequently in the field of foundations. So first of all, I'm going to define an operational theory. So an operational theory is sort of a minimal interpretation of a scientific theory. It says very little about systems and their properties. It just says, look, the primitives in which we're going to describe this theory are things you do in the lab. So preparation procedures, ways you might prepare a system. Measurement procedures, things you might do to a system that generates some outcome at the end. And so these things are just specified as lists of, you know, recipes. Here's how you do the experiment. And then the theory also has to provide an algorithm for telling you the probabilities of the different outcomes of a measurement for any given preparation procedure. And that's it. It says nothing about the properties of any system that might pass between these devices. So I can cast quantum mechanics in this sort of form. So the most general preparation procedure in quantum mechanics is represented by a trace one density operator on a complex Hilbert space. The most general measurement procedure is represented by a positive operator valued measure. And the probability rule is given by the Born rule down here. Yes? So if I think of a Hermitian operator as defining a set of projectors which sum to identity, say I'm on a finite dimensional Hilbert space, you can think of that as a resolution of identity into projectors. A positive operator valued measure is just that, but where I resolve identity not into projectors, but into positive operators. So it's just a set of positive operators that sum to identity. And so the only difference to the projector valued measure is that the projectors square to themselves. They have eigenvalues 0 or 1, whereas these positive operators can have any positive eigenvalue. So when I introduce a noise to a measurement, I have to represent it by a POVM. So in fact, all real experiments are measuring POVMs. There's no experiment that's ever measured a Hermitian operator because they all have noise. Okay, so you can actually define many other theories, alternatives to quantum theory. I like to call them foils to quantum theory, which are in this operational language. And actually, Lucien Hardy has done a lot of important work on establishing a framework for describing that landscape of possibilities. So here's the landscape, and you know, one of the questions we want to know is what picks out quantum theory, what principles might get us to here. To do that, we need a language to talk about these alternatives. So that's what this framework of operational theories gives us. Okay, but in this talk, I'm worried about experimental metaphysics. So I want to go beyond this operational approach, and I want to imagine that preparation procedures actually generate systems that have some physical properties, and measurements reveal something about those properties. We're going to ask, how well can we do justice to quantum mechanics under that assumption? So the most general thing you might assume is that when you press the button on this preparation device and spit out a system, you don't necessarily prepare a system with a well-defined physical state. If the space of physical states is denoted by just this one parameter line here, so I'm going to denote the physical state lambda. I'm also going to call it the ontic state, right? So it's the state of reality of that system. Then maybe if I know the preparation procedure, so exactly what was done, all I know is a distribution over the possibilities for lambda. So I can think of it as the preparation procedure just samples the ontic state lambda from some distribution. And similarly, the measurement need not tell you precisely what all the physical properties of the system are. It could be that, you know, for every value of the ontic state, so like say some value over here, there's just some probability distribution. So first of all, these response functions, okay, what are these? They are the probability of getting outcome one given that you measured m and the ontic state fed into the device with lambda. So first of all, they don't necessarily carve up this space infinitely finely. Second of all, they don't necessarily even carve it up into different regions. It could be that for a given ontic state, there's some probability of getting outcome one, some probability of getting outcome two, and so on. So they could be noisy. And then finally, if you want this model to really reproduce the predictions of your operational theory, it had better be that the probabilities of different outcomes of a measurement for a given preparation procedure are just the probability of that outcome given the ontic state times the probability of that ontic state given the preparation procedure averaged over all these guys. So if you have such a model, an ontological model, you have a kind of explanation of how these correlations are being generated in the experiment in terms of a physical system that's mediating between the preparation device and the measurement device. Okay, so far I haven't put any restrictions on this ontological model. Actually, I have no trouble modeling quantum mechanics in that sort of framework. The business of experimental metaphysics is really about making assumptions about ontology, about what's going on, and comparing those to the operational predictions. So in this particular framework I've outlined, you know, you might make assumptions about the ontological model, figure out, you know, you want to make some assumptions that actually have consequences for the operational statistics that that model can generate. And then you want to experimentally probe certain aspects of the operational statistics and find a contradiction. And when that happens, you know, one of those assumptions I've made about the physical reality underlying all this must be wrong and has to be revised. So that's the general prescription. And when you see something highlighted in orange, it's going to be an assumption about the ontological model. And in blue, it's going to mean something that you go to the lab and measure. Okay, so let's recast that traditional Cochin-Specker notion of non-contextuality in this language. So the idea is that every basis of, say, a three-dimensional Hilbert space is represented by some set of response functions. And so, you know, these three guys are these response functions, which are deterministic. These guys are these ones. And the assumption of non-contextuality that they made, which I'll call traditional non-contextuality, is just that the response function for ray psi 1 is the same regardless of what basis it's a part of. So it's the same response function. Another way of saying that is just the rank 2 projector orthogonal to that guy. Doesn't matter how you fine-grain it into rank 1 projectors, you always represent it the same way as the sum of these two guys. Okay, so now how do we make that more operational? How do we say, you know, what's the essence of, you know, what's the minimum amount that we need to assume about quantum theory or any operational theory to get that inference about the ontological model? And the answer is just all we really needed to assume is that we have three measurements. I'll call them M and M prime. Sorry, two measurements, M and M prime. They each have three outcomes. And there's an overlap on one of their outcomes. And what that means is that the probability of getting outcome 1 for measurement M is precisely the same as the probability of getting outcome 1 for measurement M prime for all preparation procedures that might have preceded them. That's what we know to be true. That's what it means for this ray to be the same in both bases. It means no matter what density operator I subject to this measurement, I'm going to get precisely the same probability for outcome 1 in the first case as in the second case. So that's really the essence of what we need to assume about the operational theory to get this equality of the response functions over here. So just to make it formal, if for all preparations P, these probabilities are the same, then I identify the response functions. OK. Now, if I go back to my 18-ray proof of the Cochin-Specker theorem, what it means is, you know, to operationalize that, I really say, look, there are 9 measurements, each of which has 4 outcomes. And here's what's important about those measurements, not their precise representation, the quantum formalism, but the fact that if I look at, say, the fourth outcome of the first measurement and the first outcome of the second measurement, I find that they are statistically indistinguishable with respect to all preparation procedures. That's the relevant fact about those measurements. And so what I really need to do in the lab is find some 9 measurements that have precisely these compatibility relations. Once I've done that, I can apply my assumption of traditional non-contextuality, which tells me that I should be able to assign deterministic values to the outcomes of each of these guys, and I get my contradiction. So this is a first step towards making the Cochin-Specker theorem experimentally testable. I can now tell you what you really need to go into the lab and do. You have to verify that you can find 9 measurements that have those properties. But this is actually not satisfactory because I've said nothing about how much noise these measurements have. So actually, I could verify all these properties, even though these measurements are extremely noisy. And that just seems wrong, because ultimately, the assumption that these should get deterministic values relied heavily on the fact that these were projective measurements. If I have an extremely noisy measurement, I don't expect any explanation to involve that outcome being deterministic given the ontic state. Let me explain why. Suppose I added so much noise to these measurements that their outcome was totally random, completely independent of whatever preparation procedure I put in front of it. Then if you asked, well, in my underlying model, do I expect the outcome to depend on the physical state of the system coming in? No, it should also be independent of the physical state coming in. Therefore, it should be just an indeterministic function of that state, not a deterministic function. So what it means is that the traditional notion actually incorporated an assumption of determinism, which is inappropriate. We really need to justify the determinism. We need to go to the lab and say, oh, these measurements, yes, they are perfectly predictable. Therefore, I'm going to represent them deterministically, for example. So we need to adjust, we need to somehow find something that we can do in the lab to justify this assumption of determinism. And it turns out we can do that. So I'll sort of quickly go over how that works. First of all, we revise the traditional notion of non-contextuality. We take out the determinism. Bell did something similar with the notion of locality. It's a good idea to try to separate your assumptions. Experimental metaphysics often works this way. You start with one assumption. You say, really, these was two assumptions. I need to pull them apart and analyze them separately. So we replaced traditional non-contextuality with measurement non-contextuality, which just is exactly the same, except now the response functions are allowed to be indeterministic. And so on my 18-ray proof, all I demand is that there's some probability assignment to these guys now, such that every quadruple sums to one. And that's possible now, so there's no contradiction anymore. I need to find some new ways of getting those probabilities to be close to deterministic. So it turns out that the way to do this is by expanding the notion of non-contextuality from measurements to include preparations. And the spirit of the assumption doesn't change at all. So I think the only reasonable assumption of non-contextuality is one that applies both to measurements and preparations. And if you do that, you'll find that finding a certain kind of predictability of your experimental operations implies determinism in the underlying model. Now, I'm not going to have time to go into that, the details of that. So instead, I'm just going to show you how non-contextuality, in this general sense, constrains these assignments to be slightly indeterministic, which then implies that in the lab you should see a kind of failure of perfect predictability. And that's going to get us to our inequality. So let me just do that. So what is this notion of preparation non-contextuality? It's very similar. I now think about these rays in Hilbert space as preparation procedures. Okay, so psi 1, psi 2, and psi 3 are now not going to represent outcomes of measurements, but rather preparations of a system. And here's another orthogonal basis. And now I notice something interesting about quantum theory, which is if I take an equal mixture of the elements of any basis, I always get the completely mixed state. And this completely mixed state gives a certain statistics for all measurements. And if I put in a black box either a preparation of this ensemble or this ensemble, and I pass you the black box, you can't figure out which was inside. So no measurement can distinguish an equal mixture of this basis from an equal mixture of that basis. And so the idea of a preparation non-contextual model is that the reason no experiment can distinguish them is because that completely mixed state is associated with a unique distribution over the hidden variables. So if these three distributions represent these three states, and these guys represent these states, then the uniform mixture of these should be the same as the uniform mixture of these three, just some distribution. Or another way to put it is that, you know, this equality of projectors onto quantum states will imply the similar equality for the distributions that represent them. So why should this seem reasonable? Well, remember, in the case of measurement non-contextuality, you know, the way I fine-grained a rank 2 projector into rank 1 projectors was irrelevant to how I represented it as a response function. I mean, this is exactly the same, except now I just have a scalar out front. These are not quite projectors. They're density operators. But it's the same sort of assumption. And I can do the same thing. I can make it more operational. The only thing that's really important about those states was that, you know, there's really three preparation procedures, which if I mix them with probability third each, I get some effective preparation. And it is indistinguishable from the equal mixture of these three preparation procedures. As soon as I see that in my experiment, I assume that those two mixtures are represented by the same distribution. That's the operationalized notion of preparation non-contextuality. Thank you. So this is what it looks like in terms of equations. Not so important for us. So I can almost give you the inequality now. So back to our 18-ray proof. If I take those 9 different four-element bases and I think of them as 36 preparation procedures. So you know, here for the second measurement, I have 4 preparation procedures corresponding to each of the different basis elements. And similarly, for the third measurement, I have 4 preparation procedures. So if I go to the lab and I find 36 preparation procedures, and I note that the equal mixture of the 4 from this set and the 4 from this set are indistinguishable, there's no measurement that can tell those mixtures apart. And similarly, with every other set of 4, they all mix to the same thing. Then my assumption of non-contextuality allows me to conclude that the distribution over the hidden variables for that mixture of guys is the same, is independent of I, the, you know, this number 1 to 9 that describes the measurement. And this is going to be able to get us to an inequality. So the final thing you measure is the predictability of these measurements. So I have four preparation procedures corresponding to the four outcomes of some measurement. I go to the lab and I just figure out how close to perfectly predictable is that measurement. So I'll define that as this eta function. It's just the maximum over all the outcomes of that measurement for a given preparation, that the maximum probability. So if it's perfectly predictable, this number is 1. If it's not at all predictable, a quarter for each outcome, then this eta is a quarter, all right? So this is what I'm going to measure. I'm going to just the average predictability as I range over all 9 measurements and all 4 preparations for each one. Just calculate the average predictability. That's R. OK, so it's not hard to show. I don't want to go into too much detail. But it's not hard to show that this operational predictability is constrained by the predictability given ontic states in your ontological model. And so if you just plug this inequality into that R that we're talking about, you get this formula. And then this assumption of preparation non-contextuality I just told you about allows me to replace this term, which has an I dependence, with something that doesn't depend on I at all. So at the end of the day, I just have R, the thing I'm measuring, upper bounded by this average over the ontic states for this ontic predictability. And of course, that's always less than the maximum over all the ontic states of that predictability. So now I've reduced the problem to saying, how predictable in a non-contextual model could these 9 measurements be on average? And I can compare that to the experiment. So remember that our assumption of measurement non-contextuality told me that the only probability assignments I could get for these rays were indeterministic ones, where I demand that every quadruple that appears together sums to 1. And so now I just have to ask, well, how big can I make the predictability for such assignments? And then you go to the computer. It turns out the set of W values that satisfy all these constraints of summing to 1 forms a 9-dimensional polytope with 146 vertices. Tobias Fritz has done a great deal of work on these sorts of polytopes. Ravi worked out exactly what all those vertices were and found the ones that were most predictable. And so it turns out it's something like this. I can assign ones and zeros for a whole bunch of them, but down here I need some indeterminism to make all those constraints work. And so if you work it out, you find that 6 of these bases are perfectly predictable, and there's only these 3, this one, and this one, that are not perfectly predictable. And for each of those, the max probability of any outcome is 1/2. So 3 of 1/2, 6 of probability 1, I average over the 9, it gives me 5/6. Thank you. So it says that in a non-contextual model, this predictability of the measurements can be at most 5/6. So that's our non-contextuality inequality. This is the experimentally robust realization of the Cauchy Spectra theorem. Good, so let's just review. What you need to do in the lab is you need to find a set of 9 measurements, 4 outcomes each, that have precisely these compatibility relations in this graph. You need to go and then find 36 preparation procedures that, when I average these quadruples together, I always get some things that are indistinguishable. And then you need to go and measure the predictability of these measurements with respect to those preparation procedures and figure out how large that is. If there were a non-contextual model of the world, this quantity that you found would be less than 5/6. Quantum theory predicts that you should be able to get up to 1, because I just need to prepare those pure states exactly, do the measurements of those bases, and I should always get perfect predictability. So you've got a 17% gap. And that's something that with current technology is not too hard to test. Turns out that you can do this kind of trick, what I've to tell you about, for lots of other sorts of proofs of non-contextuality. Some of them apply just to 2-dimensional systems. And so currently we're working with the group of Kevin Resch at IQC to realize some tests of these inequalities. Okay, so let me try to come back to the bigger questions about experimental metaphysics. Let's first note that now that you have one of these inequalities, you're on the right track because they're inherently quantum. If you imagine between the preparation and the measurement device putting a channel that adds noise, then you find that if that channel destroys all quantum coherence, your inequalities are not violated. So to see a violation, you need to have quantum coherence. And this is exactly like what happens with Bell tests, where you need to have entanglement between the two systems to see a Bell inequality violation. So really, it's just a question of having correlations between either preparation and measurement or these 2 measurements there has to be some quantum coherence between them. So in a sense, these non-contextuality inequalities are like Bell inequalities across time. But what's really amazing about this sort of stuff, so we've already seen this in the foundation's literature in the context of Bell inequality violations, is that if I go to the lab and I just, you know, choose a couple of measurements at random here and a couple here and some preparation procedure, even though I don't know how to characterize them in terms of the quantum formalism, as soon as I see Bell inequalities, I get a lot of conclusions. I say, oh, that preparation procedure must have been entangled. Otherwise, couldn't have gotten the inequalities. Furthermore, those measurements, they must have been, you know, not too noisy, because if they were too noisy, wouldn't have seen the Bell inequality violations. So you have a great diagnostic for your devices based on these sorts of experimental metaphysics. So in our case, you get this non-contextuality inequality violation is a witness for the fact that this channel, which you may have no knowledge of, must preserve some quantum coherence. So there's all sorts of applications for these things in quantum information theory. So there's something called the device-independent paradigm, where you try to do cryptography or some information processing task without knowing exactly how to characterize the devices. Maybe they were given to you by an adversary. And Bell inequality violations are sort of the best tool for achieving that. And I think non-contextuality inequality violations will be an equally useful tool. So other applications, there's various information processing protocols that could make use of this. So here's a PI connection. Dan Gottesman and Joe Emerson at IQC have recently done some interesting work on how contextuality appears to be a resource for computational speedup in the measurement-based model of computation. I suspect that one can also show that key distribution protocols and randomness expansion protocols could be built on top of these sorts of violations. And then finally, to sort of get back to sort of more foundational questions, you can say, well, what other kinds of non-classicality that we study in foundations, that we see elsewhere in physics, might be related to the kind of non-classicality I've described here? And it turns out that there are tight connections with many different notions of non-classicality. So for example, there's a very strong connection between these contextuality proofs and non-locality proofs. So Tobias Fritz has worked a fair bit on those connections. You can ask him about that. There's been a lot of work in recent years, very interesting work on psi ontology, whether the quantum state is real or a representation of knowledge. And psi ontology theorems, they're no-go theorems, are deeply connected to these contextuality no-go theorems. So you can ask Matt Pusey or Matt Liefer about those topics. It turns out that von Neumann's 1936 no-go theorem for hidden variables was also an example of a proof of contextuality, according to this more generalized view. And therefore, things that are sort of textbook examples of non-classicality can now be made sort of more precise in what sense they're non-classical. So for example, the fact that if I consider a particle in the barrier region in a quantum tunneling experiment, if I think of it classically, its kinetic energy goes negative, I can turn that into a proof of contextuality, and therefore sort of say very precisely what you'd have to measure in the lab to, and what are the assumptions, the classical assumptions that are violated by this phenomenon. Or the fact that the spectrum of angular momentum is quantized and independent of the reference point is another example. The negativity in quasi-probability representations, which in quantum optics is sort of the gold standard of non-classicality, is an example of contextuality, and many others. So my question, I guess, I would be very happy for all takers, if you have a particular non-classical phenomena that you're interested in, bring it to me, and I'll see if I can fit it into the mold of a failure of non-classicality. And then finally, I'll just say that on that activity of finding principles that from which one can derive quantum theory, the formalism of quantum theory, this kind of experimental metaphysics is also helpful here. Because now, for example, in this case, that you have an operational notion of non-contextuality, you can now sort of divide the whole landscape of operational theories into two parts. There's those that violate some non-contextuality inequality, quantum mechanics is an example, and those that satisfy all of them. And so you can now start asking questions like, why do we have the precise amount of violation we do, the ones that we see in quantum mechanics, not more contextuality? So we can look for principles that help us pick out quantum theory. But it also means that even if tomorrow we find that quantum theory is not quite right and it's replaced by some other theory, these sorts of experimental metaphysics have the feature that if you violated something in the lab, then you know that whatever theory is going to replace quantum theory, it has to be over here in this part of the landscape. It can't be one of these. And I think I'll end there. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. We have a little time for a few questions.
Thanks, Rob. I thought that was very interesting. Have you thought about whether this inequality you have, this R quantity, does that connect to the graph theoretic properties the way that CSW connected their contextuality inequalities to these graph theoretic quantities like the independence number and so on?
Yeah. Well, given that that result is only a couple of weeks old, I haven't had the time to see. What I would like to explore is whether all those results from graph theory can now be enlisted to derive experimentally robust inequalities. And I suspect that that's true. I suspect that all those interesting results on graph theory can now sort of be used as sort of a subroutine in finding proper bounds for any one of these quotient Becker constructions. But the cases you may be familiar with, like with Kliachko's proof, they have this bound of 4/5. That's under the assumption of determinism. So that is not experimentally robust. That's not something that you go to the lab and test, but it can be turned into something that you can test. The bound changes, and it sort of depends on what you've measured the predictability in the lab to be.
Okay, further questions?
Do you have something similar to the loopholes in Bell inequality violation, in particular the detector efficiency loopholes? Is that a problem?
Certainly, if I would sort of, in this framework, put detection efficiency loopholes in with kind of a failure of achieving low noise. So I could always just, you know, figure out, you know, the probability of the measurement succeeding and ask that be high enough to see these effects. So if the detector is too likely to fail, then that'll correspond to noise and I won't get the violation. The question of whether there's anything like the locality loophole is trickier because you don't have anything like space-like separation in these sorts of experiments. So there, the analog of space-like separation is essentially played by an assumption that you know what a tomographically complete set of measurements is. So suppose you have some experience with the world and you say, well, I've found that for this kind of system, three measurements always seems to be enough for a tomographically complete set. I've never found any measurement whose statistics cannot be predicted by these guys. So effectively, once you've assumed that, you can get these inequalities. But if that turns out to be false, then you would just have a simulation of contextuality. You could have a non-contextual explanation of a violation. So it is an interesting question, how do you gain confidence that you've identified the tomographically complete set? And I want to think more about that.
Okay, so I'm afraid we'll have to continue the discussion over lunch, so let's thank our speaker again.